And it says that we are live. Hello, Adam, and hello all of you out there on the internet. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself, Adam?
Thanks, Dan. I'm Adam Young. I'm in my mid-40s. I have been interested in Egypt for a long time, and a little over 10 years ago started actually trying to contribute in my own way. And more recently have been a little more public about some of the work that we've done. For a long time, it was just sitting around gathering data, and we have a little more than we used to. So, you know, we've started to bring in different types of people to discuss this and see how far we can push this project.
And that's the Basecam project, is that correct? That's what
that's one name for it. Yep. You know, I kind of started it about a decade ago. Alex Dunn and other people, Chris Dunn, have been involved in the project. More recently, there's other team members that that do different types of work. And then you have people like Ben Van Kirkwick on Uncharted X, who has been calling for sort of the same, a lot of the same type of work for a number of years. So he and I collaborate on certain things. And then you have people like Matt Beal and others that have been very vocal about discussing some of the, you know, some of the work that we and others have uncovered more recently. And it's just grown in the last few years, in the last 2 years, I'd say it's grown a lot. So, so thanks a lot to people like Ben and Matt Beal.
Yeah. Ben's definitely got the word out there for sure. Even if, wasn't the first guy to grab the vases, he's definitely the one that you can hear me frequently just referring to them generally as Ben's vases, because that's kind of the natural moniker. Hello, everyone. Sorry that I can't type in the chat. It's not the same as Premiere. Hello, everyone. But yeah, the popularization of those vases has been kind of a double-edged thing. It's gotten a lot of people very interested in it. And it's also gotten a lot of people very skeptical of it, which with the skeptics, often we get the cynics. And you ran into a little bit of that with Night Scarab, somebody that I've addressed recently in the past. Now, I should, before we get too far into it, I should say for clarification for everyone, me and Adam don't completely agree on the vases, but we're still able to have a conversation and move forward. It's just crazy as that is. So this isn't a little echo chamber, despite popular opinion. So if that's going to hurt your head, you might want to leave now. But so why don't, if you don't mind, Adam, what would you watch the videos that Night Scarab put out there about your presentations at last year's Cosmic Summit? And what was your general impression?
You know, I do want the criticism. I think we need it. I think it's a required, you know, component of putting forth any kind of theory and testing it out. And certainly there's been other critics that have, I think, helped and been helpful and contributed to it. I don't want to nitpick and go through every single criticism that was logged. I think there was basically two videos, one where he dealt with Ben and I together, and another one where it was a little bit more me. So maybe we can go through a few, if you want, some of the bigger topics, but you know, some of the criticism I think is legit, and then other criticism is sometimes misplaced or kind of missing the point.
That right there is that's, I just want to highlight what was just said there. Some of that criticism was legit. That's the kind of attitude that I think, if we had that same kind of attitude on both sides, where they were willing to say some of the points you bring up are legit, some of the criticisms are legit, that kind of general respectful meeting of the minds, we could actually get somewhere. Thank you, Shermanator. I see that Adam here is also on board with the being sane. All right, carry on, sir.
Yeah, I mean, where would you like to start? I'm happy to jump in.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. The first one that I had was the Providence issue. I remember the Czechoslovakian ambassador. That was a big gotcha moment of ah ha ha, we got you with that. So, would you mind unpacking that?
Yeah. Well, I made a mistake. I didn't. It had been months or maybe even longer. It might not have been like a year or two since I actually looked at the Providence, and we were in a facility in Illinois, and I think Ben asked me a question about it. And in my mind, I was thinking late 1800s, so I just messed up the date. This diplomat, he was, his name was Stanislav Kovar. He was born in 1889, and I think I had said that he brought this vessel out of Egypt in that time, but that's not true. He served in Egypt from 1934 to 47. I just double-checked it before this to make sure I had the numbers 100% correct this time. So he represented Czechoslovakia as an ambassador to multiple countries. Egypt was one of them. He was there for like 13 years. He brought a number of pieces like this back. I don't know how many. I've heard he had a big collection. And this piece in question was with him in Prague up until about 1970, when I think one of his extended family members brought it to Australia. And then from there, it remained for a while. So, you know, the provenance is it's certainly a good topic. I mean, where would we be if we were examining fake pieces or pieces that were modern reproductions? There's a number of reasons why I don't think it's a concern, but it's a legitimate point to bring up and discuss.
Okay. Yeah, that definitely makes sense. The provenance after, you say, like, he had it up until about the 1970s, how solid are the records of him having it after it just kind of appears out of nowhere, like a lot of these artifacts do?
He brought it back sometime between 34 and 47, I think. He died in 62. And so in 1970 is when it left the country of Prague. The city it was exported out of was Prague, and then it went through another place to Melbourne. Yeah, I don't know if it stayed in the country, if it left it. Okay. It's really hard to say. With a lot of these pieces, people didn't really care. These were not expensive. These were trinkets that were given out to ambassadors and other dignitaries as, here, you want something to remember Egypt by? And so I think people would, if they value them, they may insure them. They may have documented, the bill of lading if they had them shipped. If they were large, if they had a large collection, then sometimes you'll find more problems. But if they put them in their trunk, in their luggage trunk, and then pick them up a few weeks later when it got back to their home, then there's not a lot of documentation. There's different treaties with Egypt. So depending on when it was exported, Egypt may or may not have a claim on some of these pieces. So a lot of the private collectors out there are they're reluctant to share this information because they don't want to risk that the government tries to, to take them back at some point. There was wars that were fought between Israel and Egypt, and sometimes there was pieces that were stolen by different parties. So it's a complicated subject. We can get into this as well, but I think there's a lot more of these pieces in private collections than there are in public or institutions like museums.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. The provenance issue is kind of a weird catch-22. If it's in private hands, then the provenance inherently is either sketchy or it's technically going to be illegal, right? So by and large, otherwise the Egyptian government will have repatriated most of these things. So to my understanding, you would be more knowledgeable about this than I would.
It just depends on the year. If you can document it was brought out before various treaties, then you're safe. But if after that, then they would have a claim. I suspect that over time they're going to try to get more and more of their antiquities back. So, yeah. The idea in the beginning, if we rewind the clock, 10, 12 years ago, whatever it was, this wasn't like my idea. I didn't stumble upon these and think, oh my God, it was told to me. I heard about this through other people like Robert Schock, Muhammad Ibrahim, Yusuf Awian, people like that in Egypt and others. Generally, they're Egyptologists, people that were focused on this subject. They told me about these curious stone vessels, and we saw them in the museums and heard about them. My first question was like, well, what you're saying sounds crazy. Has anyone like analyzed these things and done any real work on them? Are they as perfect as they look? And the answer was, of course, no. They're mostly in museums, and archaeologists already have all the answers. And so there's no reason to go back and reexamine them. Well, as I came to realize that most of them are in private collections, most of them, like probably the vast majority of them. And I wanted to do something in some way. And so we started, me and my wife and I started looking for these things and trying to find them wherever we could in art markets and various places around the world. It's mostly North America and Europe, and started scanning them. And then when I met Chris Dunn, his son Alex and I started thinking about how we could take this further and involve other machinists and metrologists and engineers from the defense industry and contracting organizations like that. So, and I've known Ben for a number of years now. He was calling for this sort of work to be done, unbeknownst to me. We didn't really cross paths until only a couple of years ago, but he had been talking about it as well. So this isn't like my invention or anything. I just figured, well, it's so interesting. I can't not do anything.
Well, and you guys have jumped in with the space scan project, where even though I have to apologize to Nick, and Chris Dunn's son is Alex. Yes, I need to apologize. I've done it once, but I'll apologize again because there's a good chance they'll be watching this. Sorry, guys. I was a little overzealous in my accusations of you guys being a little shady behind the scenes. The first time I looked at it, I saw missing scan points and thought that maybe there was a little data manipulation. But looking into it more, that was my error. But
no, that's all right. That scan was done by me. And the software, it was an Atos blue light scanner, and the software is proprietary. It's called PolyWorks. And if you're not an expert in it, it's not easy. It's not that easy to use. So probably some things were left off of the diagram. And yeah, no, it's suspicious and fishy, but frustrating when you don't see labels from, correctly there.
That's fair. Well, thank you. But it is worth mentioning. This is really, there's a lot of work that's going in here. And even if, you don't agree with everything on these, but I have nothing but respect for the fact that you guys go in there and roll up your sleeves and go out and get all this data and produce it and put it out there. And wherever that data leads, that data could lead in a big fat circle and go nowhere, but it's still, you guys are putting in some real energy, and it's a sad thing that it's not being given more acknowledgement by academia. You guys definitely, at least the things deserve to be looked at more than just knee-jerk providence is an issue, screw all this. That's more than disrespectful. It's just sad. There's real energy going in here, real money being spent, real passion being poured into this. And I think it should be at least, held up and looked at.
Well, that is actually by design. We didn't want to really go public with this stuff for a while because the goal has always been to work with institutions. We have now, we have a number of them lined up for this year. In 2 weeks, we're going to be at our at a museum, and we have a few more in the works. So the last thing we wanted to do was, establish a social media presence where we were making wild speculations, and that would prohibit us from working with the academic community. And so that's kind of why I never even had a website or a Twitter handle really until more recently. But that's the reason. So I think we're at the point where we have a little more data. I don't think we have, the benefit of the law of large numbers by any means for statistical comparison purposes. We do have enough data. I think we're comfortable talking about some of these things. We've seen repeated results in a number of different vessels on a number of different topics and subjects. And I think we can draw some conclusions that are maybe not as controversial as people once thought.
Yeah, I think that would be pretty fair. There's a lot of things like I walked away from it the first time I looked at it, was saying that this definitely would push back some of the manufacturing equipment in ancient Egypt a long time ago. Which that would kind of lead me to one of the other things that Night Scarab hammered away at was that he said that the team claims the vessels cannot be made today. He said that was one of the things that you guys said, was that the vessels could not be made in the modern day. Is that an accurate statement?
I've never said that. People are free to speculate. And I think maybe where they came from And I think the opinion of the people that said that has actually probably changed and evolved over time. But when we first started engaging engineers and machinists, so probably like 2016, 17, 18, whenever that was, to review the artifact scan data, some of them did make statements like, oh, this is impossible. We couldn't do this today. Like, there's no way. They were really referring to their own instruments, their own machine shop. We had a few people suggest they would give it a shot with, using carbide drill bits and other things. And that was always shot down because of the concern that there would be too much damage, it would be too expensive. What is true is that the level of craftsmanship we're talking about here in some of the vases, there's maybe different grades, if you want to say that, according to how precise or accurate they are when measured. I think what is true is that the level of craftsmanship is that we're talking about in the upper echelons is not done today in stone, and it's very rarely even done in metal. So using a standard like abrasive cutting method would be very difficult, maybe even impossible as a way of making, I think, the higher echelon of these vases. So at the extreme levels of accuracy, we're talking about a thousandth of an inch in terms of deviation from a perfect circle or circularity, and even far beyond that in some cases. So I don't know if, I don't think a traditional lathe an abrasive lathe was the tool used, at least not how we're envisioning it today. An abrasive cutting tool applied to like a spinning horizontal, you know, piece of stone on an axis, that would introduce even a very slight amount of pressure would introduce, I think, too much friction and vibration. I think the tools would break, as would the vessel, the body of the vase itself. So think, for example, and Matt Beal's talked about this a number of times. There's certain vessels that have incredible thin walls of like an eighth of an inch or less. Mm-hmm. The wall thickness would be hard to accomplish alone, let alone the associated precision, but we still see it. So I'm pretty skeptical that an abrasive cutting tool like that is really the answer. I think it's probably something a little more evolved, a little more complex. Like think about like an ultrasonic, like a high frequency, low frequency tool, something like that. We have those today. Maybe that would be the answer. Maybe that's how we could do it today. Okay. Or perhaps something even more complex, like with a type of cutting fluid as the mechanism. Maybe there's like a frequency delivery system or method, like even a common metal. You don't necessarily even need electricity to introduce a frequency. So I think we're thinking about this from, you know, our own modern perspective. And I'm not saying that there were cell phones or computers in the distant past. No, I wouldn't say anything like that. But it's possible that the knowledge that underpins some of our modern tech was also known to a less or greater extent by other people in a different epoch. It's hard to imagine like a scientific and technological regime that evolved over maybe thousands of years ago, right? And our society evolved differently. Like think about the development just the past 200 years. We went from steam engine to microchips to quantum computing in a relatively short amount of time. So, and most of the world has access to it. So that's the other issue. So, you know, I wouldn't say it can't be done today. I think it can. We haven't seen it yet.
Okay. That's fair. That is one place that, you know, I would disagree with you as far as I'm less into the once we start getting out the higher frequencies and stuff, I start thinking the higher technology, the less likelihood I would attribute to it. But I would say that what you bring up about the vibration on a abrasive tool, and for those in the chat who aren't quite sure what he's talking about here, like if you're using a lathe, like a metal cutting lathe would use a metal cutting blade, some sort of metal tip to cut the metal itself. Abrasive would be using like sandpaper or something that you would use for stone. Hypothetically, that's what they say. Hypothetically, how these vases were made, according to the mainstream consensus. So I think what you brought up there, though, is a very good point that, you know, I hadn't really thought of that. But yeah, you would really kind of shake the shit out of that thing with the vibration there. You would really have to, that would have to be very secure. And one thing that I have thought about myself is ways of absolutely centering things, kind of a low-tech way of doing that is with water. It's a way to level things, a way to center things. You can use water in a number of ways to manipulate an object. But again, when you're cutting it, you kind of can't do that anymore because you can't really have any pressure pushing on that water. The water has to be allowed to act naturally. So this does present a lot of problems that aren't yes, you can absolutely sit down and bore out a piece of granite and turn it into a vase. But when you start trying to get it really accurate, you do run into some issues. So there's those guys out there that do the experimental stuff where they make a vase. And yeah, that's all fine and good, but that's not really, that's missing the meat of the issue.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
I agree with that.
Let me address what Rubate here says. The problem is not how they were made. The problem is that they exist in the first place. They ruined the traditional narrative. I think that both of us would agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So did you want to say anything more about the vibrations on that? Did you have more to say about that? Or was that pretty much covering that?
I don't know. Listen, we can speculate how these are made. I think I sort of made the decision to try to focus on just, you know, the data and the analytics. And
absolutely.
If I was convinced, I'm like, hey, there's a way that I'm pretty sure the ancients did this, or the way we would do today is X, Y, Z, I'd probably say, I don't know. So, you know, I think other people's guess is probably better than mine.
Fair enough. One of the things that he brought up too was the lug handles. He said the lug handles were for the tying off of cords. What the hell's up with that? Good reaction.
Yeah. So the lug handle. So we're talking about generally like a toroidal shape. It appears that, you know, material was removed. And so I think the claim was that the lug handles were very obviously for some sort of a stretched leather top or something. I think that was what he was arguing. But either way, some of them do have holes in them, which might indicate that they were potentially hung on something. I pretty strongly believe that the lug handle holes were added later. I did mention this in my presentation. It might have been hard to see that picture, but it's this idea of like reuse and repurposing. We find this all over Egypt and other places in the world. So think of like the graffiti found in statues, sometimes several layers deep, right? The oldest identifiable graffiti is like what's used to establish the original ownership or purpose. But that really just sets a boundary condition indicating when something was first created or when it was like first reused or repurposed. The most impressive things I've seen have no writing or inscriptions on them. I tend to think it's because they had function, not form. But most of these vessels, they don't have lug handles. Most of them don't have them, okay? Yep. When the lug handles are present, they don't always have holes. When the holes are present, they're always, from everything I've seen, always imperfect. They appear to be drilled from two different sides at disjoint sort of angles. And so you can see that from one direction. You could often see where they came in from each side and met in the middle. And the two sides are not parallel either. So, I did try to show this. It was probably difficult to see from that picture. It was a little bit grainy. But what that really means is that someone repurposed these or drilled the holes later and then potentially used them to tie a piece of leather on the top. That's certainly possible. I think the other mention that Night Scare video pulled up was with respect to the lug handles being used as some sort of a cam locking mechanism. And I think Ben has said this. I think Russ Allen's actually said it too. I don't know. I would say that the reason that that's been put out there is that I think every set of lug handles, every vessel we've seen with these lug handles, they're never 180 degrees perfectly offset from each other. They're ever so slightly off in every case, I think. And just given the nature of the exacting levels of precision used to cut and create and carve and finish the body, that doesn't seem like something other than a deliberate design element, right? So I don't know if we have enough data yet, though, to conclude anything. We just haven't analyzed enough of them to say every single one of them is off by this degree. We don't have that yet, but it does seem to be a common feature.
Yeah, Matt Bell pointed it out to me when I was in Florida to be on the Limitless podcast, and he showed me his collection, and he mentioned that and pointed out, again, the kind of thing we need more data on, and this is definitely be a lot harder to get data on, but he said that it seems to that they're a little bit closer in on the more aesthetically pleasing face. Seemed like that there was the prettier face seemed to have the handles a little closer in, but that was just a definitely a lot of room for interpretation there, right?
Yeah, that's a pretty subjective.
Yeah, but he did notice the same thing. And he had a piece that was interesting. But when you talk about the idea of a cam lock thing, which to play devil's advocate, because that is further out than I would usually. That's more tech than I would usually ascribe to these. But he's got a piece that you might be familiar with it, where it's got the blanks of the handles going around the perimeter, where it's basically you know what I'm talking about. For those in the chat, it's a small vase, and around the perimeter where the handles would be, there's all the way around, that's kind of like the petals of a flower. There's blanks for the handles where they're going to eliminate all of them except for the two they're going to keep eventually, like they're haven't decided yet. That's an unfinished piece, which is pretty cool because it shows you part of the manufacture process, but also to play devil's advocate, if they were going to make some sort of cam lock type of thing, this would be a way to, you know, fine tune it. You've got numerous ones to choose from at this point.
Yeah, that's a good point. It could certainly be true.
Okay, what else have we got here to look at that he was the vase making instructions in your presentation were not up to date.
I don't know if I agree or disagree. I mean, maybe. I'm. It doesn't really matter. I was trying to prove a point that actually you could use traditionally accepted methods to make something that appears to be a similar shape. That was my point. So the instructions are, you find your piece of rock, you use dolerite pounders or chisels, maybe copper chisels to get your rudimentary shape, your spherical shape. Dolerite's like a, it's almost like basalt or gabbro. Yep. It's like fairly hard, not as hard as quartz, I don't think. You then pierce the interior with a copper tubular drill and a hard stone bore. You place that vase in some sort of a support, either a table or a hole in the ground to keep it steady. When you then use that forked stick base drill to hollow out and make the inside, you know, perfect. And then you polish it, you finish it by rubbing the surface with, you know, an abrasive like quartz or corundum, that sort of thing. So, and corundum is more recent. It's a more recent proposal, I think. So alternatively, Egyptologists say like, well, they just use quartz for everything because they just found bigger pieces. You can also find potentially the byproducts from gemstone mining, right? So there's other explanations here. I don't really know what makes sense, but I don't think any abrasive cutting method is going to give you the results that we're looking at, the highest levels of precision that we see that are down to, you know, a 1/10 of an inch or below 1/1000 of an inch in many cases. I don't know if I mentioned this before, the Metropolitan Museum of Art did a study in 2015 where they had a piece of limestone, and they had a piece of limestone with a core drill in it, and they noticed there was some residue on the bottom of the core drill around the edges. And so they gave it to a team that used an electron microscope. So they used like a scanning electron microscope with dispersive X-ray spectroscopy. So this is, you know, a well-established way of trying to figure out what minerals are in this residue. And they did find some things. They interestingly found aluminum oxide, which naturally occurs as corundum. And so they said, oh, well, corundum, you know, we knew it. We suspected corundum was the answer. They must have been using this to cut. The only problem with that is that it was limestone. You can cut limestone with a bronze tool, and the Romans did that. So yeah. I don't think that really proves anything. I know Ben has been Ben has engaged another gentleman doing similar work, and they haven't found corundum. They found some other things, and he recently did a podcast about that subject. So I don't know yet. You know, I don't have any experience applying electron microscopy yet. So at some point, many of these were almost certainly drilled out with a core drill, right? So I have a few examples to show you. So this is these are both porphyry pieces. So this is a plate, it's a porphyry shallow bowl or plate. And can you see the core drill mark in the middle?
Yes.
They left it just as it is. And here's a second one. This is a much more impressive vessel or bowl. See if I can get the light right here. You can almost see an indentation or the residual from the cordial. It was polished. And so with your hand, you can trace down and see where the wall is polished to remove that line that the cordial left. Right? And so sometimes it was polished out, sometimes it wasn't. Why? I don't know. Sometimes it almost seems like it was deliberately left. I don't know why. And there's all sorts of theories around that too. So, you know, I think using rudimentary techniques like I described, I was maybe making fun of it and I shouldn't have been. But the point was that this stuff can give you a rudimentary shape. You can get a vessel. It's just not going to be anything like what we're looking at here with the ones that we believe are highly precise and accurate. Now, stone's a composite. It's a composition of different minerals, right? So it's not homogeneous. In porphyry, for instance, these are both porphyry vessels I showed you. You see these giant feldspar crystals like this. These are, I believe, feldspar crystals. There's other types of crystals that you might find, but feldspar is a pretty common one. It's similar to quartz. And so it's generally going to be a different hardness or a different level of strength and composition than the ground mass and the material in the rest of the vessel and the rest of the bowl. So the act of polishing is going to affect any level of precision that you accomplish by cutting it and shaping it, right? So the polishing, you know, mechanism dramatically can affect the output. So, I don't know if he's saying that there's an updated archaeological explanation of how these are made. Fine. I don't think it's going to provide us with, you know, an explanation of how this level, a high level of precision was achieved.
Yeah, they already are ignoring that as far as you're concerned. And I would agree that in a lot of ways they are, again, we might not agree on all the aspects of it, but I definitely would agree they are ignoring there are some much better measurements going on there than they're giving it credit for, at least as far as the implications at the end of the day. They just shrug their shoulders. And in this case, they just generally dismiss it as provenance. Very similar to what they do with the Great Pyramid, like we were talking about just a minute before we started the stream, how they the squaring and the distance and the alignment of the Great Pyramid, and they're just like, yeah, you just, you know, measure it out, no big deal. It's well, actually, no. It's quite a big deal.
Yeah, 700 to maintain it, you know, over the millennium. So these look to me, they look similar. I think potentially it was the same culture that built both these and the impressive monumental works such as the pyramids. It reminds me of the similar technology, the workmanship, the craftsmanship that went into their construction and design. I believe these are designed, and as well as some of the other principles like mathematical elements and principles that we find in these things too.
Do you want to talk about that a bit?
We can. Sure. I mean,
whatever. Oh, no, sorry. You seemed a little hesitant. If you'd rather talk about something else, that's fine. Whatever aspect you'd prefer to discuss.
I think we can cover it. I'll start with the end, which is that the data set's not large enough to definitively draw any conclusions, but I can talk about some of the things we found in some pieces where we have found them in multiple pieces. So it's not statistically significant, but if we found the same things in a bunch of vases, and some of the vases even look the same, maybe it's worth mentioning. So some people call this, and I use the term sometimes, sacred geometry. I don't know if that's the right word, but we're finding curious relationships between vessel components that we would not expect to find if these were done with primitive tools or by hand, right? Even like machine-powered hand tools. So while I do believe these were designed, I don't think we can draw conclusions as to or answer the questions like what or why. So far, we see things like maybe, here's one example, a common function or equation that governs the overall relationship between the different radii found in some of these vessels. So not all vessels appear to have this very special property, but some of them do, and a number of them do, not just one or two, just more than that. You have a very special vessel like that OG vase that we talk about a lot. I can pull that down and show it to you. It's in the other room. But effectively, there's no flat surfaces on some of these vessels. Every single component is governed by a radius. And there appears to be a very simple relationship that governs how all of these radii can be achieved or can be measured effectively. So knowing one, you can get all of the other ones. And I think, this is something that Mark Vist and an analyst that was working with him found a couple of years ago. And the other, the implications of this, I don't know, because I'm not sure if every single component of the vase or the vessel can be described by this one simple, elegant equation, but it seems like a number of points can. And so that could mean something. Stone's not perfectly homogeneous. So we're always talking about average deviations and we're speaking in terms of statistics, right? We also don't have an infinite number of data points. We're taking a discrete number of data points. So there could be millions, but it's not infinite. So we're never going to be 100% on top of any geometric shape or be able to calculate with 100% certainty. But you won't find that in metal either, by the way.
No.
So, one of the other, another thing here, and do you want to pull up that picture of the top-down view of the red granite vase?
Sorry, how do I put a picture on this thing? I know I've done this before once, but sorry. I am still kind of new to this.
I can describe it if you find it.
I should be able to share screen or something. But go ahead and describe it. I'm so sorry.
Oh, no worries. There's this concept of mathematical constants that seem to be found in relationships between different components of some of these vessels. So and there's one instance I was just describing why that's important. Not that it's definitely there in every vase or vessel. I don't think it is, but it seems to be this sort of very special situation seems to be present in a number of them. And so imagine, this is an actual example, but imagine, the irrational number phi, which is also the golden ratio. It's found in a lot of places, it's found in nature, but not really spherical geometry. So I showed one example of how we were looking at a vessel from the top down. And if you find it, it's the image on the right. The ratio of the radius of the outside circle, that includes the boundaries of the lug handles, divided by or to the radius of the outer top mouth section was almost exactly equal to phi. So that's, again, because stone's not homogeneous, it's not you'll never be able to say it's 100%, but it's close enough. And the point that I was making is that if we change the width of the lip and made that one of the circles a little bit, just slightly bigger, slightly smaller, that relationship wouldn't hold. Now, why would you need that to exist? Why would you need the ratio of this radius to that radius to be exactly equal to this, you know, this quote unquote Greek constant, but we know it's not Greek originally. I don't know. The answer is I don't know. And so I'm kind of hesitant to describe all this stuff because I don't really know why it's there. And we don't think that it's there all the time. And we don't have enough data to say whether it is or not. Anyway, but there's lots of different special relationships that exist within a vessel and between or among the different components in terms of the metrics. There's all sorts of ratios that we found between phi, pi, different types of constants. Of course, functions and equations that define different components with respect to each other. So you wouldn't really expect to see this, right? So I think that the point here is maybe we don't know why yet, or even all the what's, but you wouldn't expect to see this unless the designer or the machine or the tool used was following some sort of plan or schematic. Then it's expected, either due to the schematic or the design of the tool itself. For instance, like if you were to take like a multi-axis CNC machine, the machine components, they may be interrelated and they may be adjusted in some way, perhaps that's like nonlinear and scales according to like a multivariate function of some sort. I don't know what was used to make these. So I'm not saying a CNC machine was, but I'm just saying it suggests that these pieces were either designed this way or perhaps made by a machine or machines that were designed to yield this result. So then that begs another question is, was this definitely the intention? Was this level of craftsmanship in these relationships definitely the intention when these things are made? Or was the machine itself capable of nothing less because of the way it was constructed and adjusted and the way it scaled up or down? I don't know. Either seems possible. And I do have opinions, but I don't know for sure. So it's hard to speculate without having more information and more data, which hopefully we will.
Yeah. Yeah, hopefully we will. I mean, you guys keep going at it. We eventually will get more data. I'm sorry it took me a second to get the image up. That was the right one you were looking for, right? Did I do?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry about that.
Yeah. I think my point was just that whether or not you believe, you wouldn't expect to see this.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. A way to kind of bear this out where you would want to look at it from kind of to see when you talk about multiple variants on the same sphere, basically, or the same circle to use as a measuring guide, right? I'm not wording it the same as you did, but I've looked at the images. So they've got, it's basically a formula in order to find the sacred geometry that's in the, as Mark Vist finds it, right? Where it's like if you can measure the lug handles, you can measure the diameter with the same kind of, the same unit of measurement. Was that correct? Is that
yeah? Effectively, if you know in any unit, in any way, yeah. If you know the measurement of one radii, you can pop that into an equation and get all the other radii that you would then find in the circular features or spherical features of the object. And so, we haven't tested every single feature of every single object. No, it holds true entirely. And but we have seen it across multiple pieces.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. That's where it would really, where the rubber would meet the road is if this, does this show up in multiple pieces that, like the same unit of measurement, but in different pieces, that would show that unified metrology as opposed to just each piece being based on itself.
The answer is yes. But I don't know how many or the extent to how it's used, if every single piece has a different form of it. I don't know. We see accuracy and precision that varies. It can vary quite a bit. We see pieces that are accurate down to a hundredth or a few hundredths of an inch. And that's, I wouldn't say easily, but it's definitely achievable today with a lot of different types of machinery. And then we see stuff that's down to like a millionth of an inch. So there's a wide range. It's orders of magnitude different from one vase to another sometimes.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, what do we have on the... A lot of his arguments, some of them weren't too terribly bad, although they were just kind of presented almost in bad faith, I would say. Go ahead, what you got?
Yeah, some he Yeah, that's fine. I don't mind. I'm used to it. But, you know, there's some statements that were false, like when he says stone is routinely made, like I think he said like a funerary vase or any sort of stone vessel is made to these tolerances today. Like, that's just definitive. That's a false statement. It's not correct.
He had the weasel word in there that would have made me I didn't go digging deep into it, but I did recognize he says they were about the same. And so it's like, yeah. Well, hang on, we're talking about precise, and you start saying about the same. Hang on. So that's not accurate, huh?
No, I think, and I could be a little bit wrong here, but I think the only real true comparisons today in stone would be like the granite plate inspection tables that you would see in a metrology lab, where they use those because they're more impervious to changes in pressure and temperature than metal is, and they're flat. Right, so you're talking about lippage, not talking about roundness or concentricity or circularity or anything. And so I would say that, you know, we can make this in a flat surface. We do it. I don't think it's really ever done today in a spherical object at all. Not that we've ever seen, and we still haven't found anyone that's able to make one of these today. So when someone says it can't be done, I don't think you can say it can or cannot be done, but we haven't seen it done. So I think that's the difference that maybe some people are picking the words apart here a little bit, but it's certainly false to say that this is routinely done. show me one example of circularity down to it, even one thou, even, you know, a thousandth of an inch or less across just one plane in an object. It's really not, it's not there. So, you know, I would definitely argue against and push back against some of these claims that were made, but it certainly could be. And it also depends on the medium. Like, there's different types of stone. We're really focused on the granites and the diorites because they're harder, but there's softer types of stone that would be a lot easier to shape into a precision object. Like, I think marble, for instance, could probably easily be cut to something close to these levels of precision with some of the same tools that are in existence now.
Okay. That makes sense. Thank you, Little Rock. I appreciate it very much. When you're talking about the different means of potential manufacture, like they're talking about all kinds of scoop marks, and you mentioned before that you might even think that there was the frequencies and things like that, the different, lots of different kinds of things. When you guys are sitting around talking behind closed doors and your secret Illuminati meetings of the vase scan project, do you guys have a consensus? You don't have to spill the beans. I just, inquiring minds want to know. Do you guys have a consensus as to what it might be, or are you just kind of seeing what we got under the hood?
It varies. Certainly some people have put theories forth and might say something in private that they wouldn't otherwise state in public, but sure. I personally haven't seen anything that I feel is like compelling enough to restate it or repeat it. The speculation is that it was technology that we're unaware of.
Yeah. And I think that's very fair.
Maybe we can all agree on that. I tend to think it's not an abrasive cutting. We're not bashing and cracking the stone apart. I don't think that makes sense. I think the friction argument is too strong against that. I think this was just something a little bit more evolved.
That's fair. And I to be honest with you, it's I'm really glad that you guys feel that way, because like we're just talking about, for example, the handles being not need more data just on the location and stuff of the handles. Now, to some people, this might be a big fat nothing burger. There might be like, why the hell do you care where the handles are at on an ancient Egyptian vase? But that's data, and it's impressive. And the more of that stuff that we put together, that can't be a bad thing. So I can't say it enough. It's kind of sad that the attacks that you guys get at times over this is really, it's just so ill-placed. It's like, it doesn't matter if that you say aliens were throwing lightning bolts and they magically made vases when they hit the ground. The energy you're putting out there is good. So,
well, thanks. And I think a few of the points, even in the Night Scare videos, were legitimate. There's a number of criticism there that a couple things I didn't think of, and a few things where I said, yeah, you know, I should be more careful about how we phrase this or communicate it, because sometimes he was misstating or misinterpreting what we were saying or what I was saying, but I think his points are valid. Go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say what comes to mind.
Well, you want to get into the step pyramid and those?
Yeah, absolutely.
Topics. So, this is like, I mean, just to put it bluntly, Saqqara is like one of the most impressive, craziest places on Earth. So that's where you find the Serapeum, the step pyramid. Right from like the Acropolis, you can see a number of pyramids in the distance. You see the red pyramid, the bent pyramid, the black, what's left of the black pyramid. And then close by is a military base where there's more. So it's an unbelievable place. It's almost like ground zero where a lot of this stuff happened. Everybody talks about Giza, but I think there's even more to see at Saqqara. So what was I, you know, the reason I was talking about it, and one of the reasons I got into this is because I had heard the story of what was found under the Step Pyramid. That's where I believe the biggest cache of these things were ever uncovered. And as it has been stated many times by different people, 30 to 40,000 hard stone vessels were found. I never questioned the fact that that might be inclusive or exclusive of the alabaster. And the point brought up in the video, which I think is a good one, is that this could be inclusive of alabaster. And so if that's the case, then, you know, all the numbers I kind of threw out there as an example would need to be adjusted dramatically, potentially. But I don't know that. I've also seen accounts that it was 30 to 40,000 hardstone vessels and the alabaster was considered separate. So I don't really know. But, you know, regardless, you know, kind of moving on, Loyer, when he described what he found, he listed granite and he called out red granite, which I think he was referring to Aswanian granite specifically. He specifically separated the two for some reason, which is interesting because we actually see a difference in results as well when we analyze the different types. Diorite, porphyry, siltstone, slate and schist, breccia, quartz, porphyry, limestone, alabaster, or calcite. So I guess the question is, did the 40,000 number mean to exclude the alabaster vessels or not? You know, I don't know. It was the most common type of stone vessel found in Egypt was the alabaster. We know the dynastic Egyptians were skilled in working with them. They're believed to have extensively worked in alabaster and potentially alabaster only. You know, I would say that his use of photographs to count the number would not be accurate because you don't know if photographs are taken of the entire site. And his end result of 2,000 seems way, way, way too low. I mean, you can probably find that many just in museums. I've seen hundreds, if not thousands, on the private market that are attributed to the Saqqara Acropolis, the Saqqara region, or the Saqqara excavations. And I'm just one person. So let's assume that the 40,000 number does include alabaster. So maybe we discount that by how much? I don't know, half? We cut it in half to 20,000? Well, even if we cut it below that to 10 or 5 or something, which I think is low, we're still ignoring what was found before Loyer. So he was there for 2 years, right? He superseded another group of official archaeologists excavating the site that were there for 19 years. We don't know what was found there. And I left it out of my example for a reason, because we have no idea. But if he found 30 or 40 or whatever, 10, 20, who knows? If he found that much in 2 years and he was not the first person on the site, there's probably a lot more. Now, who knows what other digs that were not documented, right? So these are just documented excavations, but this is Egypt, okay? So remember the Arab Spring, 2013 or 14, I think? So during that time, the government was shut down. What happened? Well, there are illegal digs that happened all around Egypt and all these sites, from Abu Sir to who knows where. So Sometimes dozens at just one particular site, right? I think souvenir collecting or artifact hoarding is probably the second oldest profession in Egypt. So, you know, back to my example, this effectively means you would reduce all those numbers by a coefficient, right? So like we said, maybe in half, I don't know, unless you added back what you think might've been found before Loyer. So what I was trying to do here, and the whole point of this, it's really not that important, but the point I was trying to make was that, you know, what would the value be in today's US dollars if these were made in America today, according to the timelines that Egyptologists were saying, right? So just to give people a sense of how valuable, two years of a skilled craftsman's time would mean that the thing he was working on is worth quite a bit of money, a couple hundred thousand dollars, 150 grand, something of that nature, a lot of money, the price of a small house, the price of a very expensive luxury car, something of that nature, a large purchase, sometimes the biggest purchase in a human being's life, right? Now, multiply that by thousands. So it's a huge amount of money to put underground in a well-known area. It's got a giant pyramid on top of it. People know those tunnels are there. He was reusing them, right? And if he got them from somewhere else, wouldn't he be concerned that they could be robbed from him? So the point was, if they were valuable, why did he put them there? Potentially, or perhaps, they weren't that valuable. That was my point. He's not regarded to have made these. He's regarded to have collected these from earlier kingdoms, from earlier inherited or uncovered burials. I tend to think, what's the easiest way of getting, if you're the king of a country, what would you do? Would you set up excavation sites all around Egypt and pour millions of dollars into that? Or would you just go to all your constituents and say how much? Or give it over here.
Yeah.
Right? But what's the easiest way is, these were already known to have been in people's possessions. So he got them from other people or from specific sites. I don't know where. That was the point I was trying to make, was that they weren't that valuable to him because he didn't make them.
Yeah. But the Night Scarab took that and attacked you as though you got the GDP aspect of it wrong, and somehow that undermined your point.
I said something about income instead of output. So I made a few minor, just, you know, I was up on a stage and trying to tell a story. So I did make some mistakes, but the point is valid. These are worth a lot of money. They took a long time. He was trying to make points about, I think he made a few, in his own mind, valid points about, the nature of the cost of labor in Egypt. It's not relevant. We're not talking about ancient Egypt, but I was just trying to get people in a sense of what these might be worth in US dollars today. But these were not made by slaves or common laborers. They were made by skilled artisans or somebody operating, advanced equipment. So, you know, what you end up with is a valuable object. I've been below the Step Pyramid several times, and you still, I was just there a few months ago, and you're still able to step on broken shards of hard stone vases, and you can see the machine tools. You're stepping on remnants that are literally still there. There was so much there, it's still not cleaned
everywhere.
Out 100 years after all this documentation happened. The other, I would say this because I believe it's true. It's rumored, or maybe well known, that quite a bit of the backfill around the entrance to the new entrance to beneath the Step Pyramid contains like thousands of metric tons of broken pottery shards and stone jar shards. So it's also under several layers. In other words, maybe somebody thought that if we put this under several layers of backfill, we would potentially protect it for decades or for generations until we're ready to piece some of this stuff back together. There's a lot more than 30 or 40,000 that were there, I think, definitively.
Wow. Now, one of the things that I've thought, as an aside, my own little personal hypothesis as to why there would be so many of those there at Saqqara, when the first pyramid really gets built and they fill it with these ancient, vessels, tons of them. And like you say, these would take a lot of effort to make these things potentially. A lot of them had the names of rulers and noble people inscribed on them, right? Is that accurate?
Some of the, I think a minority of them had inscriptions from kings that were predating Zoser by 500 plus years.
Yeah. Ancient guys. My thinking is that this was, when they built that pyramid, it was kind of the first, like it was one completion part of their resurrection machine or whatever. And the inclusion of all of these things were a proxy for these different rulers, these different people to be incorporated in this resurrection machine. I believe those were like grave goods from their previous grave. And this was a way, like,
price of entrance.
Yeah. I don't, if you ever watch History for Granite very much, he's got a lot going on about how the pyramids look like they were set up to be used and then left. Like the only sealed sarcophagus they found had no body in it, right? Like these were, he's a hypothesis that like they were basically like stations kind of things. You would put the body there for a time and then. So at any rate, this seems like a way to be like a proxy way of including these ancients, long forgotten rulers, almost forgotten, into the modern resurrection thing when Saqqara gets built and the real pyramid building days begin, right?
I think that's, that I hadn't heard it quite put that way before. That makes a lot of sense. I would probably suggest that was a reuse of an earlier site by a less sophisticated culture.
No, I can see that. Yeah. I wouldn't argue with
if
that.
If you look at the, there's actually a lot of, there's, you know, I don't want to use the term evidence. There's a lot of support behind that. I'm not making that statement out of thin air. I've seen a lot and I've heard a lot and I've read a lot and I've been to a lot of these places. But if you look at a top-down view of the giant sort of box, what's beneath the step pyramid now, it's been put back together. You can see that it appears to be repurposed giant slabs of granite from somewhere else that I think the stories that the dynastics put that together. So they were repurposing broken pieces from some other site, some other monumental megalithic work. Might have been the remnants of what was there before Djoser, and I think he rebuilt this site. I think the site goes back much, much earlier, and he rebuilt it maybe according to how they thought it may have originally been. Maybe they thought they were going to be able to honor it. That's potential. Maybe they thought there was a use to it, and they were going to be able to solve that and fix it according to how it was originally, you know, designed to be. I don't know, but this concept of reuse is really everywhere throughout Egypt, and it, you know, it's pervasive. Like the fact that an earlier king put his own graffiti on something and Djoser didn't bother to write over it, I think is really, he could have, and a lot of them did that. That was well known. I think he just had so many of them. It was like, what's the point? I got plenty that don't have inscriptions at all. And why do I need another like 10 attributed to my name? I have, you know, 200,000 in my money bin buried under the sand. So I would say this concept of reuse is really, can explain a lot.
Yeah. All right. Cool. Yeah. I would really quickly thank you, Senorita. But yeah, the idea of the reuse, it's one of the things that really makes Egyptian, like the history, really a convoluted mess. You start reading it and it's like the wires start getting crossed, basically, where they erase this guy and prop that guy up. And I mean, to the point where it's so funny because on the one hand, it's considered such a robust timeline. And on the other hand, they don't even know if certain people are like related by marriage or as aunt and uncle or children. And just it's like, it's funny how the juxtaposition of the reliability and the fantasticness of that thing at the same time.
No, I know. There's plenty of guys named Ahmed and Muhammad.
This is true.
It's really interesting. You're talking about thousands of years of dynasties, right? And you can trace the genealogy back. Some dynasties are like Northern European descent, some are Sub-Saharan African. So it was a place where people came and wanted to live and wanted to govern and wanted to rule. Many different people over many different thousand-year periods of time.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems to have definitely been a real popular place. I mean, in our community, it gets said all the time, but it's important to remember when the Greeks showed up in Egypt during the Ptolemaic reign, Ptolemaic era, that was already like well respected and mysterious and hoary with age, like it is now, right? This mystery is really old, older than Christ.
Well, you could major in Egyptology in ancient Greece.
Yep, exactly. Right.
You could study that in ancient Greece, Egyptology. So it's older than most of the world religions right now.
Yeah, which is wild when you think about it.
And just as a religion, difficult to change.
Yep. Just as a religion, difficult to change. That's one of the things that I frequently talk about in regards to how scientists or archaeology or Egyptology will cling to its own little dogma. A great example is the carbon dating of the pyramids from the fourth dynasty. The carbon dating is like categorically a couple hundred years older than the written records say it should be. But they don't care because the written records say it should be here. So they come up with this old wood hypothesis about how they burnt old wood and that was what the thing is. And that's why it's all a couple hundred years off. And it's just a way for them to keep their written record intact over the hard data, even though the hard data, they don't want to give up on that 20-year pyramid, man. They don't want to say that it took 60 or 100 years to build a pyramid. And that's really what the implication is there. But they will maintain that written record over hard data. And that's just crazy. If you think about it, that's not science.
No, this isn't really, the subject hasn't been approached with a scientific perspective really it has sometimes, but generally speaking, it hasn't. So, it's closer to like art history, really. It's everything we know is true and we build upon that.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah. And yeah, I would go take it a step further. Anybody who would, not anybody, but many of those who would come in and try to do things scientifically will find themselves running afoul of the people that want to do things more socially or like in the clique or the buddy buddy way. Behind closed doors. The conspiracies.
Sometimes conspiracies exist. You know, with Egypt, I think a lot of it's just, dude, you want to go there? You really want to go down that road? You know, we all have careers. This is a long established thing. But interestingly, some of, you know, things have been changing there for a while now, for more than a couple years at this point. And I think the Egyptians are, you know, rightfully taking back some of their own culture and starting to think about revising some of the history that was really dictated to them by outsiders. Really in the 19th century, primarily. So that's a positive force, and there's money behind it. You know, thinking about this from a different perspective could dramatically increase tourism dollars and lead to, you know, a really an entire different set of people that would go there and be interested in the subject than there is right now. Sometimes you go there right now and you're the only person at some of these sites, which really shouldn't be the case.
No, I Arab Spring definitely put a dent in it. I mean, that's been a decade now, but when I looked at the numbers about a year ago for a video, and it was they were just now recovering about a year ago.
Yeah, and then obviously COVID didn't make things any easier.
Oh no, of course not. But guys like Zahi Hawass, he's well aware of it. It's one of the funniest clips that I use it every now and again, where he says that. So it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter what is happening bad in Egypt, those new age people, they will come. he knows where the tourist dollars come from. Arab Spring, I'm going to the pyramid to meditate.
That's what else can we discuss?
Well, we got here was the next one here, the very strict timeline of when the stone vessels should be attributed to. So he did kind of try to pigeonhole you in this tiny little spot of when those vases should have been made.
Yeah, I don't think there's really any evidence to support when they were made at all. I think they were found in graves, and you can dispute or argue when people died. You can carbon date burials. You want to throw up that map if you could, and we could.
Absolutely. Let me pull that one up. Okay.
So just to be clear, you know, as a kickoff, like just to be clear, these are regarded as being pre-dynastic, right? They're regarded as being made, generally speaking, before dynastic Egypt, sometimes into the first couple of dynasties, but never after that. And so archaeologists acknowledge these things are pre-dynastic. They're found in pre-dynastic graves up and down Egypt. And so what I did with this map is I just put together a few of the sites where we have very good documentation. So you have Lower Egypt and Upper Egypt. Lower Egypt is in the north because that's the direction of the flow of the Nile. So Giza is up near Cairo, as is Saqqara. They're both, a short drive from the center of Cairo. Tarkhan, which was a Petri excavation, I believe. Lahun was as well, a little bit further south. And then as you get further south into the middle of the country, you have Bidari, and then you become closer to Luxor, Upper Egypt, and that's Thebes, Esna, Diospolis, that's another one, and Abydea, those two are both Petri excavations, and then Nakata. So Nakata is a famous site. That was really one of the first times that these were excavated. And this work was done by others, not just Petri, but Petri was there in the 1890s. And so he had pulled out all these vases, and they were so different than everything else. And the graves were so different than anything else that he thought they were effectively aliens, not from outer space, but from a different part of the world. He thought they had came in, and they must have founded Egypt. These were like gods. Like, look what they were able to make, you know, effectively. So we can definitely say these were made before dynastic Egypt. I think I don't think that's a controversial point anymore. Now, I think some of what the Night Sky video was saying was that you have upper and lower pre-dynastic cultures that are dated far back, and then some are much further than 10,000 BC. I think he said that, but they are. And even if he didn't, there's cultures that lived at these sites of the excavations up and down Lower and Upper Egypt that had been on the scene for tens of thousands of years. that's not really in dispute. Some of the dates are disputable. So I've seen descriptions of different types of stone workshops that are dated to 50, 60,000 BC, some as far back as 200 or 300,000 BC. I don't know where those numbers came from, if they're, you know, how they were, or if they were, you know, validly conducted or measured, or even like how you would go about doing that. But I think it's believed that there was people in the Nile Valley for hundreds of thousands of years, and I've seen up to 700 or 800,000 years ago. So for most of that point, at least the pre-dynastic cultures of the last 10 to 20,000 years were effectively using the same types of hand tools that were basically depicted in many of the wall paintings, showing drills, chisels, and hammers that we find in dynastic burials from the Middle and Late Kingdom, right? So archaeologists believe they use basically sandstone, sometimes quartz and other materials. So I would say that even according to mainstream archaeology, the knowledge required to work alabaster probably existed far before dynastic Egypt. So it's possible that even some of the alabaster vases, although they're not, they probably were made by hand, it looks like, with primitive tools and primitive techniques, some of them might have been misdated and be much older. I don't know, but it seems like the ability was there long before Egypt. And I think that, you know, I think the video, one of the points that the video makes, which is a very interesting point and a valid one, I think, is this idea of inheritance requiring continuity. So he's taking apart the idea that these are inherited. He's saying, he doesn't think that the cultures from, let's say, 4,500 or 5,000 BC back to 10,000 seem to have had these hard stone vases. Now, that might be disputed. We don't see a lot of evidence to suggest that they were found in that 5,000 year window. It seems weird that they wouldn't be. If they were older, but he's basically saying that's definitive proof that they didn't exist before that. So, okay, well, let's just assume he's right about that. And they were never found in anything older than 5,000 BC. But why would you need that to be a condition, right? Why would you need that to be a condition to demonstrate that therefore they were definitely made in 5,000 BC? Why would every culture that happens to live for a period of time in like one particular place, need to have the same things, same possessions, or even value them in the same way, right? We're talking about a 5,000 year span. So for example, you have maybe group A who lives in one place and then migrates south to like the Sudanese region, and then group B takes over and then they in turn move. Well, where do they come from? Where do they originate from? Well, it would matter, right? It would matter because you're saying they should all have the same objects, the same possessions, and should all be buried the same way, or at least that we can uncover them. Then they would need to either have brought them with them from somewhere else or taking them over from whoever was there. So, you know, some of these cultures, they started off nomadic, they settled down, became fixed for a period of time, and then reverted back to their nomadic ways down the road. And they may bring with them certain things like knowledge, tools, items. So you have that possibility, that possible explanation. Another way of thinking about this is if we think about today, we see very different levels of human evolution. Not a lot, but we do see evidence of very different levels of cultural sophistication coexisting at the same time. So think of the people in the remote part of the Amazon, like northwestern Amazon jungle, or New Guinea, or even like in America, we have the Amish. We have like the Mennonites, which are in Belize, right? So you have this very different, potentially different cultures that are overlapping. You have a vast amount of time, thousands and thousands of years that elapsed. And these cultures may have been very different from one another. So that, you know, that could account for the lack of certain objects like stone vessels being found at different points in the archaeological record, not to mention, again, collecting and grave robbing is a thing there, right? So if certain cultures were buried in a way that made that easier, then those cultures would at this point look today very different in the archaeological record. Or another potential explanation is that these were first found or first rediscovered by peoples in 5,000 BC. That could very likely be true, given what we just talked about and, you know, this concept of reuse, right? So that's possible. I think that holds a lot of weight. Note that this still means they're pre-dynastic. They're still old, but there was a period of time where they weren't widely known about. Or, you know, let's just say the Night Scare video and others like it are right. They were first made in 5,000 BC. That's basically the mainstream view, right? So sure, that's of course a possibility. It's difficult to prove that. It's difficult to disprove that. But I think it's unlikely, given a few things, the manner in which these objects were found and the tools that we believe these cultures had. So again, mostly sandstone, occasionally quartz-based, fairly rudimentary hand tools. The fact that they were only found in rare or few graves, right, surrounded by pottery, much more pottery than stone, not in every grave, and the fact that these cultures were not industrialists. They were herders. They were farmers. Sometimes they were hunter-gatherers, but in many, many instances, they were sedentary herders. They stayed in one area. They did simple things. They didn't have cultural excess. They didn't have excess capacity, right? So, you know, an industrialist society would be operating with a large surplus, large excess for things like art, culture, leisure, for making stone vases, for holding body oil. I mean, give me a break. Taking 2 years or longer.
He went there.
You know, that's reserved for cultures with surplus, not hand-to-mouth groups, okay? And, of course, in any sort of tools whatsoever, even simple tools, were hardly ever found here. I think almost never. In some cases, not in a single place within a particular excavation. Now, these excavations sometimes are done 5 or 10 times in the same site over years, so we may never know what was originally found in some of these places. We didn't see anything in the way of diagrams or inscriptions on these. No written language, no account why these are there or how. So there's also excavation sites, like I mentioned, that seem to be dated to 50 to 65,000 years ago, and various types of workshops along the way that existed far beyond that, apparently or allegedly. These sorts of dates, I know they seem extreme, and I think it's debated potentially, but or it's maybe not agreed upon. But some people believe the Nile was inhabited for hundreds of thousands of years at least. So I think he makes a good point, and I think there's different explanations for why they may have been missing, or even if they were for 5,000 years.
Yeah, he did bring a couple of good points, and I think that would probably be one of them. You were pretty fair there in how you broke that down as well, even to give any more credit than I would have, to be honest. He was kind of a dick to you, so you'd be all right being a little bit of a rotten guy back, but you're keeping it above the board.
Yeah, he's an asshole. Fuck him.
Won't do you much good to be mean to him anyway.
Not that many people spend the time to go through someone else's work and then refute it point by point. So I would acknowledge that. Like, the guy spent a lot of time with what he put together, whether or not I think it's all correct, or even if it is, or some of it might be. But the fact that he spent time on it, I would acknowledge that and give it some credibility and respond.
Nice. That's definitely fair. Now, he says one of the points that you wanted to bring up was that the lathes were not used for everything. And that's something that I wanted to hear you break that down a little bit. We touched that a hair earlier with the vibration thing, but this is something that's a little bit I'm kind of the opinion that this is where we see the lathes. So this is where I'm interested to hear what you got here.
Yeah, well, even your opinion is would be considered pseudo archaeology. You're going against the mainstream perspective, which is that they didn't have the lathe, or even like simple, they didn't have the wheel.
Yeah,
which makes no sense. You know, their calendar is a wheel. Like, it's ludicrous to say that they didn't have the wheel, but they did have this thing called a pottery wheel, but they just never used it for anything else. I don't know. I would say that I think there's enough evidence to suggest that dynastic Egyptians did have a lathe and used it extensively, mm-hmm. as other cultures did. I think they were much more advanced themselves than they're given credit for. I'm talking about the dynastics, right? So back to early 3002 or 300 BC, from everything from engineering to medicine to astronomy, their body of knowledge is much more impressive than I think has really been accepted by mainstream archaeology. It seems to be changing a bit now. I think it's more recognized and regarded at this point. But I do think a lot of their culture was inherited. And that's, I think, less and less of a controversial statement. But I'm not a machinist myself. I've never designed a machine. I've never really even used anything other than, woodworking equipment. But from every machinist that we've spoken to, that I've spoken to directly or heard discussing the subject, this level, the level of tolerance and precision that we're talking about is perhaps not possible in granite using an abrasive rudimentary cutting instrument on a spinning lathe, right? Due to the friction, things that we talked about before. We see ultra thin walls. We see ultra precise circularity on a lot of these. I don't know. We haven't seen it done yet, at least that I'm aware of. So if something can be made on a lathe, sure. We also have these curious, you know, in Turkey, just across, you know, not all that far from Northern Africa, we have these curious like obsidian lathed vases, and they're said to have been made 10,000 BC. So I think the mainstream view is that they were made in the lathe 10,000 BC, which would be interesting to see if the measurements and the work are done on those. And we have these paintings, right? So what we have are paintings from the middle through late kingdoms depicting this forked stick base drill. It seems to be a way of working in alabaster. That's really all we have in terms of, you know, written or recorded depictions. And these are on like plaster walls, effectively, like painted on plaster walls in middle and later kingdom burials. Not even hieroglyphics from what I've seen. It could be a simple explanation is this is someone's interpretation of something, remembrances, like they were told this. Or rumor, they wanted someone to just paint some frescoes on their tomb depicting life, right? That's possible. I don't know. We don't really have much more than that. There's a few depictions like that. And these could, you know, I think the Egyptians and others like the Sumerians. So here's another point. The Egyptians or others like them, like so Sumerians, cultures like that, actually recorded extensively. They wrote down and recorded an unbelievable amount of material from religion to the afterlife, to import-export trade manifests. So why not speak of advanced tools that you use to make, you know, incredible objects or pyramids, right? There's no real documentation of pyramids being constructed by them. There's the evidence is indirect, and we don't have to get into it, but there's nothing that says we built this and this is how. There's evidence that work was done on the site. I think because they were made long before what we think of as dynastic Egypt, both these incredible vessels and the pyramids. I do believe that pretty strongly. And when we say dynastic Egypt, that's whatever, 3400, 3500 BC. I think the vases are directly connected to the pyramid builders.
That's definitely fair. I would think that the vases are not necessarily directly connected, but there's a very high probability of the fact that they're both enigmatic in their own regards definitely would lean that direction. And So I would defer to you on that one. Although I would say I would like to see more evidence, but
they definitely
are.
I don't know how we could ever prove that. I'm not even saying that the same people built them, but saying there's a lot of this commonality in their abilities and the knowledge base. It seems very similar, and we don't really see that in almost anything else anywhere at any time.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's it.
I've talked about it before. How you touched base on it a little bit. How we don't know what was in some of these places. I take it a step further that there's we already know Zahi Hawass is a little sketchy in these regards. But like you say, the second oldest profession over in Egypt is faking Egyptian antiquities. This is something that's been going on there for a very long time. And so if you're a guy who sticks his nose into the temple at Dendera and there is a little chunk of a light bulb sitting over there, there's no reason to give that to a museum when you could like retire for the rest of your life and your kids' lives too off of that little chunk of glass. So I think that the odds, the really good artifacts that get found, especially in Egypt, because as soon as Napoleon got that place injected into the Western zeitgeist of someplace cool, It's still there now where people will just go nuts to have anything Egypt. So I think the best stuff, there's a very good chance that it's been missing and always will be missing.
Yeah, 100%. I would 100% agree with that. A lot of families, old families in Egypt, would have storehouses in their backyard for holding antiquities for a period of time so that they could be sold off piecemeal over generations, right? Wow. So this is a well-known fact. I've seen enough out there to know that I think I'm pretty sure there's hundreds of thousands of these things out there. Yeah, I think that's accurate. No, there's not 2,000. That's ridiculous. There's hundreds of thousands of these that were uncovered, that were excavated. There's probably more that weren't. So were there millions made? Probably. Maybe not. Maybe that's high. That could also be low. Yeah. If there's a machine that could make these with relative ease, and I would say relative ease just because the alternative doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense that people would sit down for so long to make something that's so mundane for holding body oil. I mean, come on, pottery does it just as well. So I do suspect there was a lot of these made, a lot more than people realize, and it was easier. than the traditional explanation.
That's a fair position to have, and I could understand why that would end up sending you down the rabbit hole of checking the metrology on them multiples to see if you could find any evidence of it going that direction of mass production, for example. If you start finding five of them with the same lip that you have some decent provenance, for example, all of a sudden it's like, well, they made the lip a specific way. That would be, you know, even more leaning into that.
Right.
And as you guys do more and more research, and as you get more and more museums, hopefully on board with the whole thing, data like that will eventually start to kind of sift itself out, but we're still in the early days of it. You guys are still in the early days of it. So, and you get a lot of pushback, it seems, as many people that would let you look at the vases in Cairo. For every one archaeologist that says, yeah, let them scan a vase, you've got 10 that's like, well, we should just encase these in concrete and never let them see them. So,
yeah. And there are, there are vast quantities of these that are not on display in museums. Like, for example, the first time I was in the Cairo Museum 10, 12 years ago, there was like basically one case with maybe a dozen of these things in one specific area. You could see it wasn't hidden, but it was just a few of these up. The last time I was there earlier this year, I think there were at least hundreds, potentially more than a few hundred. So in various displays, they even had an entire section dedicated to these things. So I don't think they're necessarily being covered up. I think they're maybe not understood. There's a reluctance to go back and redate things. You have, I mean, imagine spending your entire life dedicated to a specific paradigm. Your career is based on something, or you're going to be reluctant to rewrite that. You're going to be unwilling to even see a possibility that you could be wrong. So I think it just takes time.
Yeah, I wouldn't argue with that. And the fact that it's become a touchstone or a flashpoint in the whole archaeology versus pseudo-archaeology debate doesn't help at all. Like you said at the beginning of the video, where you're trying to get scientists involved, and it's, it can be very difficult when it's viewed through these lenses.
It's difficult. I would say that most scientists, engineers, machinists, people of that caliber, metrologists, when they look at this, they're the easiest people to convince, because they're used to looking at data, they're used to doing this type of work. Immediately they're shocked and stunned. The archaeologists and the people that are of a different background, like more of like an art history background, less of a less technical background, if you will, are harder, a lot harder to convince. And that's what we, but those are the people that hold the keys and the locks to the gates. And so we, you know, I'm being very careful in the way that we're, you know, reaching out to them, and hopefully we'll be working with them more and more into the future. But, you know, it's one of the reasons that I don't really like to speculate too much, other than I do think these are much older. I think there's plenty of suggestive evidence and some direct evidence to show that, and statistical based evidence, if you will, that I think shows that these things are much older, that these were inherited. You know, I think the other point, and maybe I should just address this, you know, before we end, we could go on all night if you want. I could talk about this for a long time.
Oh, I'm good if you are, but I don't want to push you. I know your time is valuable, I'm sure, but I could go for another half hour easy if you're good.
Yeah, it's just, you know, if I hear someone screaming in the background, I'm going to be called down to take care of some kids. But
oh, okay, I understand.
That's the limit to how long I can talk about this. The certain sites. So there was some maybe confusion, discrepancy, criticism, valid criticism with respect to pictures and sites that we're referencing. So we could get into that a little bit. So, you know, that map, there's a reason I showed you that map, is just so you can see that Upper and Lower Egypt, there's lots of different sites. Those are just a handful of them. There's hundreds of sites that were excavated. Some major sites were excavated 10 plus times over the years, over the decades, over the last 150, 200 years, just by the archaeological community, not to mention all the stuff that's under the radar. Probably far more illegal digs existed than legitimate ones. So I thought that, you know, I try to be careful typically and only reference the sites where the stone vessels were definitely documented to have been found. If I slipped up, you know, I acknowledge that I may have made a mistake, or I may make mistakes and not realize that certain sites, they weren't really there. But remember, there's also conflict. There's also mistakes made by archaeologists. And so you sometimes may see museum pieces that they don't always attribute the location by which these were originally excavated or uncovered, but sometimes they do. And sometimes those could be wrong. It wasn't really from there. It was from somewhere else. That happens all the time. Remember, these are not necessarily focus points. These were not highly valued antiquities. By the discerning eye, they were interesting and curious, but people wanted statues of cats. They wanted busts and heads. They wanted human statues, right. Hieroglyphic, right. You know, motifs chiseled and removed off of a wall. Those are the things that were valuable. These were not. There's lots of them. So they just weren't that valuable. And so the attribution in terms of where they were from, the provenience, where they were excavated and when, isn't always accurate. It's not always even maintained. So sometimes that could also lead to us making mistakes. It's not deliberate. We're inadvertently jumping to conclusions. And in some cases, I don't think it's as important. You know, we've talked about the fact that these were, I think, machined. I think they were made to exacting levels of precision and accuracy that aren't capable by hand. They were machined, I believe. And the fact that they were not found in certain places and found in other places is interesting, but not necessarily related to that. And recall that, you know, we have the grave robbing issue. So when vessels are said to have been from a specific place, and we see a picture of that place, and we see a picture of what looks like potentially stone vessels, yeah, we may jump to conclusion and say that looks like stone. It might not be. But I don't think it really matters. These are regarded as being pre-dynastic by Egyptologists. I think the point is that imitation was also everywhere too. And so that led to problems with form-based dating. I've spoken about this a little bit. And form-based dating is something that was really pioneered in, I think, the mid to late 1800s. It's discussed, and this problem has been discussed in published research papers, but I think the conclusions aren't necessarily where I would go with it. I would say, listen, if two vessels look similar, one is stone, one is pottery, and you're dating them both to the same age because they may be found in the same place and they look similar, yes, they could be made by the same group of people. But why? Why would you make something incredible and then imitate it in a much more in a much less precise manner, in an inferior technique, in something that doesn't even look the same, and then bury them both together with the same person? Doesn't that kind of reduce the importance or the significance of the better one, the higher quality one, right? And if you're capable of making these in stone, you know, why would you bury both the stone and the pottery in the same manner with the same person? So it's, to me, that doesn't really make sense. And I think this goes back to the concept of inheritance. These were spread across a wide region, up and down Egypt, at least, up and down the Nile. So we would expect more like leadership burials, significant people like the king or the chieftain or the leader of the region to have a higher incidence of, I think, these stone vessels. We don't really see that, at least from what I've seen or heard. We wouldn't just see this sporadic incidence in every couple of graves here and there. I think you'd see more caches. Maybe there are more that haven't been discovered yet. Maybe they're still out there. But I feel like we would see more similar to Zoser, maybe not to that extent, but at least like more than a couple together. I think where did they get them? Where did Imhotep and Zoser get them from? Well, they had been clearly around long before him, and they were already owned by prior groups of people, like Narmer that you mentioned and others. Did he collect them from the current owners? Did he perform excavations of his own, or did he get them from the existing owners? I feel like this would have been amazing to have been, you know, friends with those guys and just going around like kind of bargaining. You're going to like antique shops. You're haggling with like locals for their stone vases. That would have been pretty exciting. There's a lot of sites up in the Nile that had these stone vases, lots of them. And so if me or someone else makes a mistake in the name, we made a mistake. That's all. Many of these sites are dated to a time before dynastic Egypt. Most of them are. So from the primitive nature of these burials, the lack of tools, of course, the rarity in the presence of these stone vessels, my conclusion is that these were heirlooms and inherited. And the people we see buried with them did not make these, at least that much. I don't know who did.
Yeah. Well, it's clear right off the bat, like we mentioned earlier, it was just chock full of the vessels with the names of older people on them and older rulers. So it's clear right off the bat when we first, the first big cache, the only big cache that we know of, that's correct, right? The only big cache that we know of was at that pyramid, right? Issaquara?
That's the biggest number I've ever seen, but there were other large caches found. So Nakata, so Petrie, if you look at a book published by Petrie, you'll see plates, or they basically would take like a table or something and lay out dozens of them, right? So he did find caches, but those would typically be dispersed amongst individual burials, not like in one burial. It would be like one barrel has one vase, and then five or ten barrels have nothing, and then this other barrel has two vases. Each one, almost every one, or most of them would have plenty of pottery.
Interesting.
And so it was just the incidence of the hard stone.
Yeah.
In comparison to the pottery, is just so much less than I think you would expect, especially when you're talking about socio stratifications and classes of people, like who's a leader, who's important, who's not. Yeah. I think you would see more small caches, 5 or 10 perhaps. If they were able to make these themselves, they would probably have more of them. There's not enough that to me indicates that they made them.
Okay. That is fair. It's interesting. I didn't know there was more caches found. So, you know, I'll have to dig into this more. See, I learned something. Learn something new every day.
Well, they're not big, but check out like Lahoon. There is some stuff found there. You know, look at what was found in Nakata.
Nakata.
Petrie didn't. This is late 1890s, so he didn't really take very many photos. I think he took a few photos here and there. So I don't know if he uncovered any big burial chambers, you know, big mausoleums where there was like a few dozen. I really don't know. And I can't say if he ever found them in large groups. It's possible, but they were found in a somewhat confined geographic area that's then known as a cemetery.
Okay. We'll have to look into that some, because this stuff is definitely interesting to me. And that's data that had slipped right through my fingers. I hadn't seen that one yet. The ideas of the heritage requiring continuity, we touched on pretty good there. It's one of the things, though, that I think that I would like to kind of just flush that point out a little bit. We see this numerous times throughout human history where something falls out of favor and then gets picked back up 100 years or 1,000 years later or whatever, an idea or a recipe or all kinds of little goofy shit. That the fact of the matter is, this could have been not being made, but known of for a very long time. Take a wax cylinder for a Thomas Edison's phonograph, right? Nobody's made one of those in well over 100 years, but we all know what they are. And it's the same kind of thing could very easily be here, where they all knew what these vases were. They were part of the culture, but they just weren't something that they were making. And then for whatever reason, they picked them up down the road. His take on this one is very much a debunker's kind of lock it down take, and it as such kind of doesn't really represent a logical model of reality, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not a bad topic to talk about, though. Like you were saying, like why is it not valid? But and we did already discuss it. But you also don't know if every culture is going to want to bury them.
Yeah.
Right. Would you bury a wax cylinder?
No, exactly. Yeah.
You may, if you're a primitive culture and thinks, holy shit, look at this thing.
Yeah, that's right. Right.
But if not, you may just keep it in your attic and then your house burns down and it's gone.
Yep. That's right. That is absolutely right. So let me, I'm just going through the list of everything here, because it looks like we touched most of the big ones that most of the points that he made. Oh, the photos are deceptive. That was the one that we talked about that, I guess, a little bit. But I can never pronounce this place right. Tushk, however you pronounce it.
Tushka, yeah. So Ben's mentioned this site. So this is in the Nubian region. It's basically so south of Aswan. Aswan's like the last major city in Egypt. It's really nice. It's a really nice place. Like wonderful people. Like really, it's lovely. It's hot as all hell in the summer, but it's a really nice, pleasant. You're there and you're walking around. There's cafes and shops and everybody's really friendly. South of that becomes eventually what's known as the flooded region. So when the first dam was being built in the early 1900s, there was sort of this rush to go in and try and maybe preserve and catalog and save some stuff. There, a number of countries came together to move Abu Simbel they cut statues with giant circular saws and move them up out of the way of the floodwaters. And then there's hundreds of sites that go that trace the old Nile effectively, and it would be in the banks and little islands, and then in the middle of what's now Lake Nasser as well. And these excavations, I think they tried to do them. They did them quickly. In many cases, they did them multiple times. We also don't know how often they were hit or robbed before that. And so there's not a lot of data showing what types of vases were from that region. And I think in some cases, there's some selective photographs, and it might show what looks like a stone vessel or a stone plate or a stone bowl. And I think the point in the video was he found an excavation record that said it was just potteryware, not stone. And I think it may have been Ben that was pointing to a photograph, or I may have pointed to a photograph that was, and indicated, I think this was a picture of stone and it wasn't. So again, like we may have jumped to conclusions sometimes, but the point is these things were found in pre-dynastic burials up and down the Nile. And the photographs weren't, as widely done as we would have liked.
Okay.
So we have the best records, the best ones that I've seen from Nakata, Petrie. Everything Petrie did was generally well documented. He was a surveyor by trade, so he had this technical background. Thebes, Saqqara, Abydos, Hawara, which is a pretty interesting site. Giza, of course, Lahun, Badari, and then others. And so some of these sites, coincidentally or not, actually you see the most stone vessels from the sites with the best documentation, right? Poor documentation makes it easy for the vessels to go missing and to find their way into worldwide antiquities markets.
Makes sense.
Again, like to your point, I don't know if there are any other large caches that were ever uncovered. If they were found with dig sites that were illegitimate or under the radar, then you wouldn't expect that it would be in the record.
Okay, that does make sense. It's too bad that so many of these things got kind of just jumbled up over the years, like you mentioned, with the vases being so valueless for so long. It's the kind of thing that, like, it's a great example is the Czech ambassador who just kind of gives it away. Here you go, buddy. I got this cool vase here that's kind of, it's nothing. It's not even worth as much as a scarab. It's cool. You use it as a paperweight back in those days. So the documentation trail, even the pictures and stuff, is just all a big old jumbled mess. But what
it is the best documentation is from the diplomats who didn't want to be accused of stealing. So they may have been given, in some cases, they were given more than one, a number of them. But like I have a few pieces that came from heirs of diplomatic families. Like, this thing's in the attic, let's get rid of it. Oh, we can get, a few grand for this. We can get some money for it. Yeah, get it out of here. I don't want it. So that was the mentality for a long time. I'm sure it's not anymore. But it was for a long time. And a lot of these people have pretty good records showing when it was taken out of Egypt. And we know when they worked there, when they lived there. So we're confident in this stuff. But like I mentioned, I don't think the province is that important right now. And the main reason is because it would be very difficult to replicate these to create forgeries or fakes. Very difficult. That's not impossible, but it would not make sense. Up until the last few years, these things were not expensive.
That's the next thing I wanted to touch on really quick was in Night Scarab's first video talking about the vases. He brings up a Chinese manufacturer that he claims he contacted that would make these for something like $300 a vase or some shit like that. I forget the exact number. But he doesn't give very many specifications or really any specs. He just kind of says, this guy would make some vases. These guys would make vases for me. Have you looked into any of that at all? I just wondering because I know that you have a lot of dollars tied up into these things, right? So,
well, to some extent, yeah. Don't forget that I've had these for a while. But we've been looking for people that can attempt to recreate these or make one using modern techniques, right? So one of the granite manufacturers in China is in a region that's known for black granite. It goes back thousands of years. The people there are highly skilled. I was put in touch with him by another colleague and friend of mine. And I just asked him, like, hey, do you want to give this a go? And he's basically like, yeah, we usually, these days, nobody really does this in granite. This is done in marble. If you wanted to make this, you'd use marble. It's a lot softer. He's like, but we'll give it a shot. Thinking that, if they can it could prove something and help. And so it was, you know, he did it basically for on a volunteer basis, essentially. And they just used a core drill in the center. They did not hollow out the body cavity. They didn't have any tools that could do that. They didn't want to try to repurpose any existing tools because they were concerned about breakage, right? Not even carbide, but any normal drill tip is going to,
yeah,
going to be faced with this intense level of vibration friction that you're going to break these things. You're going to break your tools. You're going to damage your machine, your aperture. Everything is going to be is going to suffer a lot of wear and tear trying to cut granite to this level of accuracy or precision, whether or not you're spinning it or you're using a CNC machine. Your machines are going to experience monetary damage that, in I think many cases, unless you really know the exact way to do it and minimize that, isn't going to be worth your time, right? So there's vases that years ago, like I think maybe one of the first ones I bought was only $2,000. A couple thousand dollars. That's after, you know, and that's taking into account that the art broker might take 20%. 25-30% sometimes, shipping, insurance, all of those things get into it. So who's actually making money? Are you going to go through the wear and tear on your machines to make $1,000 after shipping and commissions and everything? That doesn't make sense. That's not legitimate. And that's why the provenance has not been a major concern. Moreover, this was kind of a dry run, right? If we can show that this level of precision and accuracy was being used, we can take that knowledge and then and then use vases that have been under, you know, continuous unaltered ownership by museums and other institutions and hopefully publish. And so that's the goal.
That's a good goal too. That's really where it'll take the next little step, because like I've mentioned a few times now, the provenance is, you know, it's the go-to argument against this stuff. It's just a quick way to dismiss everything and a lazy man's debunking. Why address all those big numbers? I can just, provenance. Well, of course, provenance an issue. It's freaking Egyptian artifact in private hands. So,
but it would be an issue if we weren't talking about what we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, if somebody's wanting to be a debunker about it, it's the provenance will always be a loose thread they can pull at. An Egyptian artifact in private hands, generally speaking, they'll have something they can do there. But like you say, the there's no point to faking the things. For the longest time, scarabs would have been worth way more to do. The easier to do, the Egyptians knew how to do it. A statue of a cat would sell better all day long. So,
and for 20, 30 grand, it's worth your time. Not trying to make $1,000 and you spend $5,000 on materials or whatever it is, plus the cost of labor, which isn't, and if you're granted, overnight. So it didn't really make sense. It does make sense now. They're getting a lot more valuable. Yeah. And so it's a legitimate argument. I think I would say that there could be fakes out there. I don't believe I've seen any. I don't believe I've seen anyone in modern times using modern equipment to replicate the accuracy and the precision in hard stone, granite, diorite, etc.
Hey, by the way, just to make sure to put this out there really quick, Adam, I wasn't saying that you were like investing and buying and selling these things. I just was saying that you had a number of these that, as they appreciate, you know, that's something that's worth money. So I figured that you might have an idea as to what the cost was on reproducing these. I'm saying that you're buying these to resell or anything like that. So.
Oh, right. Yeah. No,
I just want to put that out there. I'm not calling you Zahi Hawass over here.
Well, I'm not aware of anyone that can do this. I'm not aware of any forgery shops out there. Not that they publicly advertise, but I think I would have heard about them. I know a lot of people that live in Egypt that are very in touch with everyone. They know forgery shops. I've seen Egyptian forgeries, and sometimes to an untrained eye, you could fool people. There's different ways they use sand and other things to make things look older than they are. There's all sorts of things that are forgeries. It's not uncommon. It's very common to see Egyptian forgeries in everything else other than these.
Yeah, I know the scarabs were one that notoriously, like, they would make a scarab and then feed it to a goat. And that was the way that they would age it. Was...
Right.
Makes sense. But I've got some old magazines from I first got into Egyptology and stuff when I was a kid, really. And I've got magazines from when I was a teenager. And it's funny because two different KMT magazines, which is like an Egyptology nerd magazine, from the turn of 1990s, and both of them have one artifact that was found to be a forgery since then. One of them's covering in the magazine, and the other one that happened about 10 years later, but it's super common, just super common.
Yeah. And I know I've heard a lot of stories. I think it is everywhere, but, you know, this is a nice way of preventing that. Like,
yeah,
the knowledge of these. Now, I don't think that, like, in the beginning I was buying some of these things, based on two-dimensional photographs, right, that you're seeing digitally online. Yeah. And in most cases, I was able to look at something before purchasing it, but this is before we scanned it. And so I was going out on a limb saying, well, who knows? Is this a forgery? As we started scanning this and hearing from engineers and machinists, their opinions on the ability to do this today and the feasibility, you know, I was more confident that it probably wasn't.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
So you were showing a report?
Oh yeah, I just figured I just was putting that up there real quick. Put that back up there again if I can. Wrong one. There we go. All right. Yeah, it's just one of the reports there. Like you say, the numbers on those are really good. That's a cause for a lot. It should be a cause for a lot more debate, but the debate seems to center on the provenance currently, which I will be very happy to see. Here in the future, I'm hoping that as you guys start hitting the museums and this becomes a little bit more mainstream, I'm hoping that we'll see these numbers discussed a lot more in detail instead of just being like, oh, there's some guys in China that'll do this, nothing to see here. Or, you know, there was no Czechoslovakia back then, LOL. And that's not really, I mean, that's all fine and good for making like a 1 minute short, but for an actual video addressing this stuff, that's kind of vapid.
We've seen enough from different places that to have provenance, they've come from all different sources. We've seen enough, and we've seen enough that are so precise as to baffle people that commonly attempt this in metal, or that don't attempt it in metal because it's too hard. So I don't really need to see any more. Now, I think the bigger questions are, how common is it to see the ultra precision? Because there's lots of stone vases, and they don't all look like this.
That's fair.
We don't know. It's a minority of them, but we are filtering. We're using a bias. Like we're only really analyzing the ones that look good. We're not analyzing the ones that don't look good because it's not of interest. But that should be included in the data set if you're going to try to ascertain like how much of this was, how prevalent was this practice. Sure. We need to look at the ones that aren't perfect. At least count them in the denominator. Maybe one day, but again, I don't know where they all are. I think most of them are in private hands, so we're never gonna have firm data on how common it was, or some of these other questions. But perhaps we can get to a point where we can say, all right, you know, what do they have in common? What are the features they seem to have in common? What does that say about the potential design, potential use, or potential reason for making these things? And maybe able to answer some of those questions.
Yeah, well, you're definitely pushing us in that direction. I mean, it is telling that there's so many rumors about the vase scan project, and that's not what I'm seeing here talking to you. You want to actually like take and work with the scientists and work with the museums and stuff, and the rumors tend to be that you guys just want to hide off in your own little corner and scan the vases and tell each other what that means. And it seems like nothing could be further from the truth, but I'm looking forward to see the future.
That's why it unfolded like this, is because I was trying to keep a very low profile, you know. I don't know if it matters as much anymore, and there seems to be more acceptance. Like, so when we first started presenting this idea, this topic to museums and other researchers, it took me 9 months to get the first few PhD, and these are mechanical engineering people at a different university in Egypt, to actually like engage. And this is after sending them information, trying to get them on the phone, trying to get them into a conversation. Once they saw the data and looked at it, they were close to convinced. And then it kind of evolves from there. So the biggest hump is trying to convince somebody that what you're doing is not speculative, it's not crazy, it's not unfounded, and that we really want to try to use the scientific method if we can. There's no other way to do it. You know, we postulate a theory, we test it, we shoot it down, or refute it, or accept what's provable or what's disprovable, and then kind of go from there. But it helps to have dreams and helps to have, you know, ideas, because without that, it's not as interesting. And yeah. Speculating a little bit's okay, because it tells you where to look.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the guiding light, but it's like, I believe a few things that I think are probably true. Hopefully that they turn out to be true, but if not, it's okay. We're still on a path.
Yeah.
So
that's that kind of attitude right there. That is, it's beautiful to hear you say. I would say really quick to address what Ed Frutextual later said, a logical speculation for the stone choice for manufacturing. The material was relatively easy for the culture to work with, or the material possessed a specific characteristic needed for intended use. I could see that, especially if you're looking at the lost ancient high technology route. The latter one there definitely would be leaning into that. But the first one, granite wouldn't be something that's easy to work with, I don't think, in any situation, unless they really got something we are unaware of.
Now, some stone's softer, and you know, you do see some vases that appear to be marble. I don't think I may have one or two that are marble. We see other softer materials, and we know where some of the stone comes from. Not all of it, actually. By the way, we don't know where all of it comes from. We know of a few diorite quarries. There's one in the Red Sea. Aswanian granite, obviously, and Aswan, it's fantastic. When you go there, I think you'll go there. It's pretty, yes, pretty awesome. Just to see this old, you know, effectively abandoned quarry. They still use it, some parts of it, but the main focal point is incredible. We know where a type of porphyry comes from. There's porphyry that was quarried from Mount Kilimanjaro.
Oh, wow.
Right, okay. Tanzania. And so some of it came from there, because there's two known places in the world. There's Tanzania and Mount Kilimanjaro, and then there's, I don't know the name of it, if there's a volcano in Antarctica. And so I'd say they probably went to Tanzania.
A little bit more likely.
Right. But there could be other places. We just don't know. We know there's a corundum quarry somewhere. I don't know the name of the town. It's in Egypt. And I think there's basalt quarries. I believe there's still continuously operated basalt quarries somewhere in Egypt. I think Ben may have been there, or he knows about them. Ask him next time. But we know where some of the quarries are. We don't know where all of them are. Does it matter? Well, it does sort of matter. But then again, if we know where a lot of them are, they seem to be somewhat local, like they're in driving distance. They're in donkey, you know, they're in, yeah, they're in horse or camel distance, whatever, then maybe that's enough. I don't know if it really matters. Like, does it matter where the stone came from? Well, it matters if it's deep underground. Sure. But it's there. There's vast quantities of it. It matters in the context of megalithic stoneworks, like pyramids. Like, if this stuff, yeah, came from hundreds of miles south, you know, if red granite came from Aswan and it was trucked up, or sorry, it was riverboated up or whatever, however it got there, up to Giza, up to Saqqara, that's, yeah, interesting. You know, some of these, there's pieces that are 100 plus tons. And so that's really nice to know. But I think with respect to the bowls, like, some of these are this big. They could have been remnants from other building projects. I don't really know, and I don't think it matters. I think the main point, sorry, doesn't matter as much. It does matter. I think the main point is why they selected certain stones. Like your the last person that commented said, yep, maybe it was because of the function. It was required because of what they expected to get out of the piece. Sure, these could have function. You know, Chris Dunn and others have speculated they were components.
Yeah,
in a machine like resonators, they were used in conjunction with something else to modify, amplify, filter, manipulate, mm-hmm, frequency. Maybe, I don't know. They could, other people speculate their time capsules. They're meant to encode information, knowledge about sacred geometry, about universal principles in nature. Mm-hmm. Sure. I don't know. Any of those things could be true. They could all theoretically almost be true at once, but you know, that's a long, I'd like to know a couple of answers before I die. I don't really think we're going to get all these answers. I may get a few of them, but I don't think I was getting all these answers.
You know? No, but you guys are definitely pushing us in the direction. And, you know, just as a guy on the sidelines, I just want to say thanks, Adam. I mean, I know it's
thank you.
Weird. But no, seriously, thank you, because this is cool. You know, lots of people are doing stuff in this community, but what you're doing is definitely what you guys in the Basecamp project's doing, even for all the people that think that you guys are grifters or whatever the hell label they want to slap on you guys are doing good work, and I've got nothing but respect for it. Even if I don't agree with you on everything, I mean, that's your knowledge base. You taught me a couple of things that were factual here tonight, and your knowledge base is impressive. And if you keep doing things the way you're wanting to, in another 5 years, the academics will not be able to ignore you because, well, some of them will be on board, at least with some of what you have to say.
Well, thanks. Thanks for the kind words. I think you'd be surprised how someone can get on board with some of the concepts of what's in front of you, what's black and white in the data, and you know, in a point cloud data set, you know, that information was captured by an acceptable, you know, device that is used for quality control in manufacturing. Yeah. It's very hard to argue with things like that. There's different types of devices like that. There's scanners that are 2, 3, 10, 50, 100 times more precise than others. And so sometimes that's questionable. You can question the data to the extent that, like, was this captured properly? Was the work is done correctly. Like we're applying the correct metrics and statistics to the algorithms and the code that's used within the programs that are calculating the numbers. But it's always a question, like, is the data captured correctly? Can it be captured in a better method? We started using CT scan data a while ago, a year or two ago, and kind of backed off it. The CT scan data is many times thicker than a laser or blue light scanner like GOM makes or structured light scanning, because it's using X-ray technology. So you have just an incredible amount of data. That's a lot more. There's many hundreds of millions of data points sometimes. However, that the X-rays can sometimes pick up interior points in a vessel. So what do we really want? We want the exterior and interior surfaces, right? We don't really care about what's inside. It's not hollow, but if it was, that'd be nice to see. However, sometimes if there's large feldspar crystal inclusions or just the material is very heterogeneous in nature, the X-rays will pick up certain points. You know, this is stone with sometimes diverse mineral content. And so what do you do with that data? How do you know if it's interior? We don't want to exclude data. That wouldn't be correct, yeah. Right? We don't want to filter the data. We don't want to manipulate it. We don't want to artificially say, exclude all this, take all this, and just use this. Well, then that's bias. And so it's difficult. You know, we're looking for solutions there. Hopefully it's in the design of the X-ray equipment itself. So Zeiss, which actually came to own GOM, that makes that Blu-ray laser scanner. Zeiss now has CT metrology equipment that I think hopefully, ideally, will be able to, you know, through software or hardware, potentially avoid some of that and filter out some of those data points. But the CT scan data, you know, whether or not you filter out the data, we're getting much better numbers. We're seeing numbers that are much higher in precision than we would see with a structured light scanner. So I think those are legitimate points for consideration and should be debated. Like, what should we use to capture data? How should we do it? Is it worth it? So structured light scanning data, which is not as precise, is showing numbers that still indicate that these people had something much more advanced and much more evolved than they're giving credit for. But how? I think we need to continue to work with the X-ray technology and then eventually look at surface deviations with electron microscopes. So there's a lot more to do. There's a lot more work that should be done. Hopefully it will be.
Yeah, well, you guys keep it up, and I think that it will be. It sounds like Ben's got quite a it's become very popular in the last few years, right? He's done a great job of popularizing this, and then guys like yourself in the backfield there with just now coming out and sticking your nose out, I guess, about a year ago, but like still as you said, you know, not a lot of people are aware of you. You're not trying to publicize it as much as just do the work. But Ben, publicizing it's a good thing because we got so many people that want this stuff done eventually. Even the most diehard skeptics in Egypt, again, those new age people, they come. They'll get those vases off the shelf if there's a dollar in it. So, really quickly, ancient vacuum. I hope I'm reading that right. Water from above is a secret to Egypt that can power tools. Yeah, they're definitely. I've seen hypotheses for that for decades about like water powered saws for cutting limestone blocks and all kinds of stuff that the Egyptians may have used.
And maybe in different and surprising ways. So there's certain ancient temples and sites where it appears there's water running in a specific design underneath the site, mm-hmm. just below the subfloor. For what reason? It doesn't appear that it was directly turning a wheel or powering a tool, although it could have been. It could be something else. It could be energetic. Mm-hmm. It could be related to a different form of energy. They talk about it in the Egyptian lore and the Egyptian hieroglyphs and their stories and their. I don't want to call it religion because it didn't start out as a religion. The word Neter meant force of nature and became a religion later on. They talk about these things. They talk about many more additional types of energy than just the several that, you know, just the EM and the other stuff that we know about today. They talk about the fact that there's others. So, you know, I don't want to throw too much out there and be speculative, but, you know, I think there's a good chance that somebody at some point had maybe a knowledge that was in excess or more advanced than we have today in certain ways.
I wouldn't argue with that to a degree. Like one thing I've mentioned a few times talking about this stuff, and it's a good thing to mention here, is stone was the premier material for building and making things with for literally millions of years of hominins. Millions of years. They passed this down before humans. And so when humans started working metal, the loss of knowledge, as father didn't teach his son how to do these things, the loss of knowledge when that got cut was immense. There was a lot that was, and a real salient example of this in modern times, in World War II, there were a bunch of impromptu sniper schools that were set up all around the globe by the U.S. military. Because they didn't need any real approval. The brass would just say, yeah, go teach you guys to shoot. But these were the first things they would roll up when they started the end of the war and they start sucking up the budget, tightening the belt. 20 years later in Vietnam, the NCOs on the ground are requesting snipers to be trained, and they don't have any snipers in sniper schools. They actually had to go to the U.S. Olympic marksman team to teach their men how to shoot because the skill set was lost in just 20 years. So a lot was lost, in my opinion, when we quit working stone, and that could very well be the key to how these vases were made and how pyramids and a lot of these things. And in my opinion, it's less amazing than other people's opinions, other people's imagination might take it to. But no matter how it is, it's a mystery, and you could label it a lost technology.
It's the attribution is lost. Like if dynastic Egypt built the pyramids, how come they didn't document it? There's no documentation whatsoever. They never even they almost never mention them ever mm-hmm. anywhere. If there's the most impressive thing you've ever seen in your backyard, why wouldn't you be talking about it? I mean, there are accounts like in the beginning was the Benben, which is supposed to be the primordial mound that everything came from. It's possible they thought that the pyramids were godlike. I don't know.
Yeah.
But the term Neter meant force of nature. You know, all their quote unquote gods were not originally gods. It was science.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a lot of possibilities out there. I don't have many answers, but, you know, I think sometimes the hard work is its own reward. You know, you've heard stories like that, the you know, the journey is more important than the destination. Well, I think that's probably true in this case too.
Well, it sounds like it. It is impressive. I mean, again, let's see the work that you guys are doing. It's one of the things I've noticed a lot in the alternate history community is the reputation of a group of people compared to the experience when I started talking to him is night and day. And it's, oh, yeah, these guys just want to sit around and blah, blah, blah. And you start talking to you guys. And, wow, you want science and museums and legitimate stuff. You don't just want to sit around and circle jerk all the time. It's crazy.
Yeah. Although I don't mind speculation, especially especially if you're drinking together. It's nice to talk about something that everybody is interested in. But the rubber has to meet the road at some point, and we need data to discuss. And otherwise, we're just kind of telling stories. So I don't think this is a story. I think it's very legitimate. There's questions though. There's not a lot of answers.
Well, keep working, and I think that we'll get some more. That seems to be the direction we're going. Yeah. So I think this is probably a good spot to call it. What do you think, Adam? I think we've touched the bases of everything that we had on the list, I believe. Did you have anything else you were wanting to hammer at?
No, we I think we touched on a few things, and you know, thanks for the time. And
thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it. I'm really glad we were able to make it work. I know you're a busy guy, so thank you.
All right. Take care, Dan. Thanks.
Awesome. Thank you. Take care, Adam. Thanks a lot, chat. You guys have a good one. We will see you next time.